In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Sweet Tarts dare to combine sweet and tart, but we didn't stop there. We combined soft and bouncy to bring you new Sweet Tarts Gummies Fruity Splits, a uniquely delicious dual-sided gummy with one side that's sweet and one side that's tart, but entirely smooth and squishy. Mmm, a powerfully perfect combo. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. On today's episode, we're bringing you a fascinating conversation with a winner of this year's Dan David Prize. The prize, of which History Extra is a media partner, recognises outstanding scholarship that illuminates the past and seeks to anchor public discourse in a deeper understanding of history. Today's guest is Dr. Miriam Brucius. Based at the German Historical Institute, London, Miriam researches how museums can broaden our understanding of visual and material culture in global and colonial contexts. She was interviewed by the author, broadcaster, and public historian Helen Carr, who's working with us on this series. Dr. Miriam Brucius, welcome to the BBC History Extra podcast, and congratulations on your achievement as a winner of the 2022 Dan David Prize. I've got so much to ask you, as your work on the history of museums and display is incredibly current, particularly as many people are confused about how we should judge the past. Before we begin, would you mind introducing yourself, your role, and importantly, how and what led you to study cultural heritage?
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very pleased to be here. So I'm currently a research fellow in colonial and global history at the German Historical Institute based in London. And I study questions related, as you just said, to where museum objects come from, how did they get to Europe, and why are they in European museums? And while this is something that is currently very much on the mind of people and public debate in the UK and elsewhere in Europe, I have started to look into these kind of questions around 10 years ago through my work in history of photography at the British Museum, where I looked into how photographs are used to basically make sense of museum objects. And at one point, I got more interested into what these objects actually are that were depicted on the photographs and what these sites are where they were excavated. So it's mainly archaeological objects that I'm interested in. And so this is what took me to the current research that I'm working on now.
Looking at museums and the way things are displayed, who do you think is at the center of this museum narrative? And
do you think this has been shaped and perpetuated by colonial collectors, you know, going back to the origin of the museum?
Absolutely. I think what we're still seeing right now on museum display is very much still the narrative that was shaped in the 19th century. And even though there have been generations of curators who I appreciate have been trying to do something different, I would say that the general overall mindset and framework that museums operate in are still very much bound and sort of dedicated to 19th century ideas of collecting. And even though that might be something that is not very conscious, it's precisely the fact that this is kind of made invisible. So you see very little context about how ideas and taxonomies are itself something that museums should be exhibiting. So I would say, yes, it is still a narrative that is very much in the 19th century, even though it many people feel that we've moved on. And also, yes, it's still a narrative that is very much bound to historical male, white, upper class figures, such as Hans Sloane, who was fundamental in shaping the collection of the British Museum, or Alexander von Humboldt, who was important in the sense that he contributed to collecting in the history of collecting in Germany. And so even the names of these new museums still reflect that. So yes, I would say things have changed, but more change is needed in that respect.
So these objects aren't generally being presented in a way that speaks of those who originally used them. I mean, this is obviously important. So how do you think this could be done effectively, you know, particularly in reference to indigenous knowledge and use of the objects and material culture?
So I'm currently working collaboratively in a project called 100 Histories of 100 Worlds in One Object. And to British listeners of this program, this might kind of sound familiar because there was a program 11 years ago called A History of the World in 100 Objects that was co-produced by the BBC and the British Museum, and mainly under the curatorship of the then director, Neil McGregor. And what he tried to do is to tell a history of the world using 100 objects of the British Museum's collection. And 10 years after this famous book and radio program came out, a group of people, and I was one of them, we organized a workshop in Jamaica where the origin of the British Museum collection can be located. To basically turn this story upside down and to make the point that one object can in fact have 100 histories of 100 worlds. And so there are all these different narratives and histories about objects that have been left out often in the museum narrative, and that I think these are the stories that we need to tell now. And that's very often about not just the journey of museum objects and how they got here, but also the story about the function that an object can still have now in these cultures and communities of origin.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this workshop that you organized. So I'm just going to repeat the title of it, The 100 Histories of 100 Worlds in One Object. And this conference, you know, explored how the objects came to being in the collection, which is the main difference to the BBC and the British Museum project beforehand that you talked about. But I think it's interesting that you chose to host this in Jamaica, because you've written so beautifully about this, and I'd just like to know more about why you chose to do this. And I ask that because it was seemingly an influential and important part of the critical experience and the point of the workshop in telling how these objects came to being part of a collection.
Yes. So the project now is a website with resources and podcasts and essays and reviews where we tell these object histories in a different way. But it really started, as you said, as an event, and we chose Jamaica as a place to convene this workshop precisely because Hans Sloane in the 18th century went there to collect a museum objects and specimens, natural history specimens that formed the collection of what is now the British Library, the British Museum, and also the museums in South Kensington in the 19th century. So the collection was later dispersed. And we thought it would be interesting to basically do this journey that the objects did in reverse and go back to where these objects come from in order to adapt to a point of view from of the country of origin. And what was really powerful was the fact that the event took place at the University of Mona campus, which is part of the University of the West Indies, and the name already tells us that it derives from the idea of empire, right? And because it's a university that was founded as part of the British Empire. Jamaica used to be a colony of the British Empire, and this campus used to be a plantation site. So it's basically a graveyard of enslaved people, and we saw some of these remains on site. We also looked into the history of the transatlantic slave trade that was, in fact, fundamental in supporting, in a way, also financing these kind of collection histories. So it's a very violent history that actually underlies this history of collecting, and seeing this, shifting the geographical focus to this former site of violence and the former colony really sort of reframed the entire project for us. And it was it was a very powerful, very moving event. We gave our first object histories on site just to sort of test out, you know, whether that would work. And so we had 15 people from around the world taking the objects that Neil McGregor had originally chosen and just telling their own version from the point of view of these countries of origin. And doing that in Jamaica while also connecting to people in the heritage sector on site made all the difference for us, because it's also about shifting the focus away from the metropolis of empire, a place like London, where everything sort of always seems to come together, and really going, venturing out to the peripheries of the former British Empire, and to see it literally from the point of view of these sites.
One of the things that that came out of this workshop that I found interesting was the concern for the relationships around these objects, you know, the intangible emotions that they contained from past contacts. And you describe treatment of these objects as being a one-dimensional narrative. What do you mean by that? Is it a case that in exhibiting these, we're really just lacking empathy for the people within the story of that object's past?
I think so, yes. It's a narrative that kind of also erases the fact that these objects did not just magically appear in the museum collection. So that's the first thing. We need to understand how they got there in the first place, who took them, that they might not have just been acquired in the museum, but that someone might have taken them in a violent colonial context. Not all of them, but many of them. And so I think it's important to tell that story, and that story would then also acknowledge the labor that went into taking these objects, because often, especially in the case of archaeology, but also in the case of natural history, there was a lot of indigenous labor that went into collecting these objects. So, for example, you had locals excavating the finds, maybe not being adequately paid for that. And so there is a story on a local level that's related to labor, first of all. And it's important to highlight that and no longer erase it. But then secondly, also, it's about the meaning of these objects and the meaning they have had in the past in these cultures, in these countries or empires, and that they might still hold today. So if I can just give you one example. So there's a famous object called the Akan drum. at the British Museum.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
And the British Museum had finally decided to highlight the fact that this is an object that is related to transatlantic slave trade. And we definitely should acknowledge that. You know, there have been things happening on that front. And the British Museum is now, you know, has an exhibition about that part of its history. And the Akan drum has been presented as an object that is related to the slave trade that came originally from Ghana and then made its journey within that context. However, our digital editor of this project that I just mentioned, Benjamina Efuadatsia, she decided, who's originally from Ghana, decided to tell a different story about this object. So she said, that's all very important. And yes, it is important to talk about the transatlantic slave trade and highlight the violent history of these collections. But ultimately, that would also mean that it's all about Europe again. And it's all about the British Museum again. So that is something that is very much at the heart of the project as well, to not just shift away from the metropolis of London and Europe in itself, but also really tell a story that can be also a positive story about the function of these objects today. And so what Benjamina did was that she took this object and she said, we are still using Akan drums in Ghana today. And then she conducted an interview with her favorite Akan drum band. And they basically explained, you know, how these instruments are used today, the rituals that are attached to them, and so on. And so these are objects that are very much alive, so to speak, not just in the past. They were not just alive in the past. They also, many of them are alive now.
So because of this historic centering of the metropolis, do you think it's possible to recover marginalized histories through objects? And, you know, how far can a museum go with that? Can they explain gender or ethnicity? I mean, you just mentioned the example of the Akan drum, which is a great one, which actually, I suppose, in itself demonstrates that it is possible. But I just wonder if you could expand on that as to sort of how we might be able to tell a wider story rather than, you know, shifting the focus from these colonial attitudes.
Yes. That is exactly the challenge. So I should also add that usually historians work with archives when they want to look into the history of an object. But of course, the archives that we have available, they are also the archives of the powerful. So if you look into only the institutional history of the British Museum, what you get are letters and correspondence of exactly the kind of people that we talked about before, the men, mostly men, and middle and upper class, privileged white senior males who created the collection. And so this entire narrative that many refer to as the subaltern and the marginalized, that is not necessarily in the archive. And so what I, in my own work, tend to do is I look it for information between the lines in these archives. So I sort of look if I can find something that is sort of that might not be directly mentioned, but that it hints at something. It's interesting always to look at logistics and the kind of people who supported the transport of these objects. But you will not find the names, for example, of the people who excavated, say, archaeological objects. That is very, very rare. That you find a logbook of the people who helped with the excavations, for example. So what I'm saying here is that it is a methodological challenge, and we need to develop new methods, how we can actually tell new stories about these objects. And I think oral history, for example, would be an avenue to write also women and other ethnicities back into that story. However, not everyone who was involved will be alive today. So one way of doing that would be to talk to people who maybe this kind of knowledge was passed on over generations. And it is surprising how often that is actually the case, because unlike in Europe, I think oral histories and exactly that kind of oral transmission of knowledge plays a fundamental role in many countries in a way that it does not in Europe, where we tend to document everything on paper and, you know, take the minutes and so on. But there are all these stories that people know, also about objects in the museum collection, that can be retrieved even in a third and a fourth generation, and they can yield very interesting stories. And so to give you another example, for example, the Rosetta Stone, which is also a very famous object in the British Museum collection, has been mainly exhibited under the famous name of Champignon, who deciphered the script that was on this multilingual stone. However, our author, Heba Abd El Gawat, who is from Egypt and also an Egyptologist, she retrieved a completely different sort of point of view by talking to people in the city of Rashid, where the object originally came from. And she found out that the people from Rashid were actually involved in the decipherment of the stone, and that the city has its own sort of local history that is also connected with colonial encounters at the time with the French and the British, and that, you know, there's a local narrative to be told, and people still have maybe not direct memories, but kind of knowledge passed on over generations that still matter for the identity of the place today. And these are the kind of stories that we need to write back into the picture. And it's up to museums to sort of figure out how to do that. And I think the only way to do it is to involve people from these countries, but also the diaspora. A place like London, it's actually not very difficult to find people who come from the places where the objects come from, and to ask them what their point of view is about the items in these collections.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I hope that my work will show that when we care about material culture, that ultimately this is not about something material, it's about people. So we should care about objects because we care about people, and create awareness for the fact that the reason why these objects have meaning is because people see meaning in them.
I really like that you use the example of the Rosetta Stone and how people were involved within its, you know, from its origin were involved in its translation. And that makes me, it sort of segues very neatly into my question. You know, how far by removing an object from its original space do we actually lose its story? I mean, through the process of removing it, does it just become data because it's taken completely out of context?
It is problematic, and data is a very, sort of very clinical word, isn't it? Related to knowledge making and science and all the rational things that that people also hope to find in these collections, because often these collections were used for scientific purposes. So they were not just there for pleasure, but they were actually there to be studied and to be used to retrieve future knowledge. And that is still the case today.
Especially if you're looking at archaeology. I mean, archaeology is effectively in many ways data collecting.
Absolutely. So yes, I mean, you still see when you go backstage to study room of the British Museum, you can still see scholars there sitting there deciphering cuneiform tablets. But also, unfortunately, and I looked into this recently when I studied the collections in Berlin, unfortunately also there are still cases where human remains are still used for scientific research. And it's claimed that it's all sort of morally and scientifically justified, but there are definitely problematic aspects about that. And so, yes, data is definitely something that the people who originally built these collections were after. And absolutely, I would say that removing objects from context always takes away meaning from them. And in particular, if you look at archaeological objects and how they could potentially live on if they weren't in the museum, you find exciting stories. You find stories such as people using antique objects to build a new house or to sort of integrate these kind of antiquities into their rituals, into their daily lives, into their vernacular practices. And the sites that we now perceive as authentic, authentic sites of antiquity, such as Palmyra or many sites in Greece, in Turkey, and so on, they are, in a way, they are artificial, right? Because often they were created in a process where European archaeologists went in, they took some of the objects to bring them to European museums, and they kind of sanitized the rest of the site by removing people who were actually using the site to live their lives. So we know of cases where there had been villages in sites such as Palmyra. And so what was interesting about the debate that we had a few years ago when ISIS destroyed some of these sites was that the fact that these sites had already been destroyed by European archaeologists to remove objects in order to bring them to European museums, that aspect had also been erased. So there has been destruction in the past, but on the part of Europe. And I think it's important to acknowledge that the way that European museums preserve objects, that's not the only way to preserve an object. An object can also be used and live on in a different context. And often this is the case in these sites, or it was the case in these sites.
There's so much discomfort when we talk about ownership and how objects should or could be shared globally. And you call this object fetishization, which I love. It's obviously important to understand global histories, but what would you say to those who feel confused about where they stand in this debate? And importantly, how they could be critical of what they are looking at when visiting museums? You know, how can people themselves, when visiting these museums, decolonize the way in which they are viewing these historical objects?
I think we probably reached a point where museum audiences no longer go to a museum and they take them for granted. I would hope so. I mean, it's not been an easy debate. As you said, there has been a lot of discomfort and a lot of pushback as well. But the pushback is only a sign of something not having gone right. It's there is pushback because something's at stake. And people at large, society at large, realizes, okay, maybe this has been an unbalanced story and we are about to lose power. The pushback happens because there are parties in that story that feel we are losing power or the dominant narrative that we have been benefiting from. And so I think the debate, no matter how difficult it has been for some people, has definitely moved forward in a way that enables people to go to a museum and not sort of take this space as something that has a universal worldview that applies to everyone. But I think there's definitely more of an awareness now in audiences to ask, okay, but why are these objects here and what do they mean? And I think it would be interesting to look more into visitor books and to have more information about that, because I definitely think that in a multicultural city like London, people do leave feedback and they do question certain things. And it's only a matter of time where, you know, museums have to take up all these demands. So there are people out there demanding a new narrative, especially in a city where school classes are so multicultural. You need to offer a story that is not just one narrative, but tells a sort of mutual or shared history, especially for communities from South Asia, the Black communities who live in this country. And I also want to stress the fact that this kind of work is definitely already happening. So we shouldn't be talking just about the British Museum. There's great work happening in the museum sector exactly on that front, and many curators having awareness for these demands. And I think it's good as a museum visitor to challenge what these museums do and to tell, they'll need feedback, say what kind of stories you want to hear and see in a museum. Also ask your museum, you know, how does that relate to who I am? And why does it matter? Why are these things here? Why should I care? And bring the communities back into the museum. So it's not just about creating a more global, inclusive narrative. It's also about creating a more inclusive narrative on the local level, really. And, in a multicultural society like Britain, that is actually not too difficult, because the world is here as a result of empire.
So finally, Miriam, how do you think your work will shape discourse around the history of museums and display moving forward? And just adding on to that, also, how do you hope it will make the most impact on our popular understanding of cultural history?
I hope that my work will show that when we care about material culture, that ultimately this is not about something material. It's about people. So we should care about objects because we care about people, and create awareness for the fact that the reason why these objects have meaning is because people see meaning in them. And so I think it's important, or I would hope that my work can show that we need to write the human and the people back into that story. As you said earlier, remove away from this object fetishism and create a more social history of these objects. So that's one aspect. And the other aspect I hope to highlight is there's so many objects in museum storage in Europe. And it really, that is a reflection of this kind of, again, a fetishism, but also a strange way, a strange desire of preserving something for the future, while nobody quite knows what that future is and what we even need these objects for, and for whom, and why they are here. And so I think at an age of repatriation, it's important to ask, what do we want from these collections? Does everything need to go back? Maybe not. If objects stay here, is there a different story that we should tell about them? And really look at the collections that are not on display in a new way, but also use repatriation in a way that, again, isn't just about the return of something material. It should be the start of a new conversation about equal partnership and relationship between Europe and its former colonies, because the social inequalities that are still prevailing as a result of empire are still a problem. And so I think ultimately, the museum and these objects, they are just the start of a conversation. They are literally the tip of an iceberg. And this should be about equal distribution of funding, new economic relationships, and many more things. And the museum is just a sort of material embodiment, hopefully, of a start of a new conversation on a global level that is about inclusivity and equality.
Thank you so much, Maroon, for coming on the podcast. That was fantastic. And congratulations again on your very well-deserved prize.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Miriam Brucius, Research Fellow at the German Historical Institute, London. She was speaking to the author, broadcaster and public historian, Helen Carr. Miriam is one of the winners of this year's Dan David Prize, the world's largest history prize, which recognises outstanding historical scholarship. If you'd like to hear more conversations between Helen and other winners of the Dan David Prize, you can access the whole collection early and ad-free now at historyextra.com/Dan-David-Prize. And you can find out more about the Dan David Prize, including their events and the other winners, at dandavidprize.org. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt.